Craig Erland, market analyst at OANDA. Very good morning to you. Let's kick off with how markets and first oil prices have actually changed now that it appears as though both Iran and the US are pulling back from hostilities.
Yeah, we've pretty much fully unwound the positions that we're building over the last few days. We have to remember that this was potentially a massive story. I know everyone kind of maybe over-exaggerated it in the early stages, talking about World War III, but that doesn't mean that this wasn't a major macro story that could potentially influence everyone's lives. And that in itself may sound like an exaggeration, but I'm only talking from one aspect, being oil prices. We know that a spike in oil prices historically and previously has caused recessions, so it's not unfathomable to think that if you engage in a war in the Middle East around a key channel being the Straits of Hormuz, that you could potentially actually trigger such a spike in oil prices that it negatively impacts households across the world. So I think from a number of different perspectives, both in terms of potential lives lost, which obviously there hasn't been any, there's only been one at this point, to the impact that this could have had on the economic scale, I think this is a massive relief for everyone. And maybe it comes as a bit of a surprise because this escalated so quickly and so unexpectedly. I think that was the important thing. And it's de-escalated just as quickly. When we may look back on this in 6 months, being like, remember that time back at the start of the year when for 3 days it looked like we were heading for an all-out war and then it just so quickly disappeared?
There are going to be two aspects, I would say, that we'll be looking at further into the year. One of them is the domestic side in the US. We obviously have the election of a US president in November, and this kind of foreign policy rhetoric is not unknown in a re-election campaign. I suspect we might actually be returning to these kind of topics as the year goes through. But there's also the situation in Iran. They've lost a key leader, but also one who was likely to be a successor to the current administration further down the road, and somebody that has been talked up in terms of their sort of hierarchy in terms of the public. Are you looking at sort of wider ramifications for how Iran deals with its neighbours in the Middle East and how that might influence markets as we go through not just this year but into the future?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think it's quite clear from both responses that all sides wanted a de-escalation of this. The reasons for that may be different on different sides. So obviously you look at the Iran attack and you say there was no casualties. If they really wanted to make a statement here, if they really wanted to a proper retaliation for what is an important loss on their side, you would think that there would have been casualties. So I can't help but feel like that was completely intentional, a warning of shot of this is what we can do, but we don't want to escalate this any further if possible. But we also don't want to be seen as weak. And I think from Trump's perspective, he wanted to escalate this crisis further, then I feel like he would have done, but he took a lot of time to make that statement yesterday. That's very un-Trump-like. Mm. He took to Twitter. There was one tweet. It seemed very, very prepared and very relaxed and very calm. Again, that's not very Trump-like. I wonder what surveys he's seen over the last few days as to how the public's responded to a potential conflict with Iran and decided, you know what, politically this doesn't work for him, even in an election year. Like you say, historically this actually worked quite favourably, but maybe he's seen some numbers which suggest that they're just isn't worthwhile. But we've seen before, look at last year, Iran lashes out in different ways. Just because they've decided to de-escalate this particular conflict, it doesn't mean we won't see further things arise over the course of this year.
So let's move to the UK retail sales, which fell for the first time since 1995 when those particular records began last year. Now, we obviously... yes, retailers are having difficulties across the developed world in how they react to changes in supply chains, the rise of the internet and, you know, opportunities for buying cheaper things, effectively. The UK, though, has had a particularly politically bumpy ride as well. How much of this do you think we will see going into this year as well?
Yeah, I do think it is going to be a consistent theme because this isn't just the result of an economic slowdown. This isn't like in 2007 where we saw a financial crisis and we saw Woolworths disappear off the high street, among others. This is coming at a time when we're still growing. Yes, the economy is slowing and we've had Brexit uncertainty and we've had, it seems, a culmination of difficulties for the high street. But this is actually probably equally as much an effect on things like business rates, but also the impact of Amazon and other online services. having finally catching up with the high street, and maybe you'd look at the Brexit situation, the uncertainty and the impact on consumers has been the straw that breaks the camel's back in many senses. You look at some of the names that we've lost this year, from Jamie's Italian to Toys R Us was the year before, but you know, there's been so many different names that have disappeared off the high street over the course of the last 12 months, so these kind of figures aren't that surprising. But it is also worth pointing out that the PRC figures do they do understate the sales online. So, for example, Amazon aren't included in the figure. So we can't really take this as a reflection of the entire consumer environment. For example, also the spending in pubs and restaurants rose over the last couple of months in the year. So it could just be that people are moving their spending away.
Yes, and understandably, I mean, the BRC are reporting their members, and as you know, it's focused obviously on retail, the clues in the name, but also that older, more high streets. That's what I'm saying, that effectively sales are moving across. But after a tough year like this, given we've had, you know, tough years in the past, but, you know, not of this standard in terms of sales, are you expecting more businesses going under in 2020?
I think there will be more businesses going under in 2020. Whether we see it to the scale that we've seen this year, I'm not necessarily sure about. I think, as always in these situations, that what it does, what these situations do is they highlight the weakest of the bunch, effectively. And I think ministers have been distracted in Parliament, have been distracted now for the last few years with regards to Brexit. They're not going to be less distracted per se over the course of the next 12 months, but they must be looking at this situation saying, what can we do to alleviate? So we've heard a lot more over the last few months about business rates and what can be done to kind of support various high street firms. There's obviously been various takeovers, and I'm sure there's been a lot of planning over the course of the last number of months in order to say, we don't want this. Because it's not just, we have to remember, the reason why Jamie's Italian and others are struggling is not just because is not because of the same high street problems. That you can attribute some of that to the fact that the lower footfall on the high street affects therefore the eateries and everything that comes around it. So it is quite important for the for not just the high street retailers. It's important for the entire areas in many towns and villages, etc., that a solution is found here. And I do think there are efforts being made to try and work towards a solution, and this is probably the worst year.
Greg, we had the first meeting between Boris Johnson and Ursula von der Leyen, the new president of the European Commission, yesterday, in the role of president, and looking ahead to the new trade talks between the EU and the UK. Both parties, after some humiliating meetings between previous prime ministers and on Brexit with the EU, both were surprisingly or unsurprisingly fairly relaxed. They said what they wanted to say, and we now are looking ahead to the negotiations. It's going to be a difficult 11 months, though.
It is going to be a difficult 11 months. It's a bit easier to be relaxed now, though, for two reasons. One is they've agreed the terms of the withdrawal, so both sides have a clear understanding of what the other wants in terms of the future relationships. You've got a basis for these negotiations to begin on. Also, it's 11 months till our next Brexit deadline, so it gives you time to be a little bit more relaxed than you would maybe be come September. But I think it's quite clear from the comments that we have had over the last couple of days that you've got one side that's very ambitious that a deal can be done and says that it shouldn't be too difficult to get this done by the end of the year. And you have the other side that sees far more difficulties with it. So clearly they're not fully aligned on how these negotiations are going to go. Naturally, the more you want to move away from the regulatory side of the EU, the more complex it makes the negotiations. And but then, like I said, we are in the early stages of these negotiations. We're seasoned now in how these negotiations go. The early stages are all cordial, etc. But as we move on through the year, I'm sure we'll become a little bit less relaxed. And I don't know, maybe there's going to be some fatigue here, so maybe there'll be a lot less hype.
Yes, my intention isn't to start picking problems and picking holes ahead of time. And yet we can already see where the tension points are going to be. So for Boris Johnson, the one red line he has set above all else is the deadline, the end of the year. That is going to be something which is going to become a challenge as the year goes on, if it comes down to hitting that but missing out some of the content. You know, which way would he go? But the other side presumably is going to be on the three rules that the EU has set forward: no tariffs, no quotas, no dumping for a decent trade deal. No tariffs, no quotas, everyone's terribly happy about that, but no dumping and the kind of control that the UK has over the businesses and the industries in the UK, that I suspect is going to be more of a challenge.
Yeah, and I think we kind of covered this in the kind of year in review preview thing that we did a few weeks ago. In that, there's two things that we have to look at with regards to these negotiations. Yes, the two sides currently have different ideas on how they would like the future relationship to look in certain aspects. Like you said, the no dumping thing, no tariffs. I think we've heard plenty about now is no tariffs is the easiest part of the negotiation. Everyone agrees that they don't want tariffs on the vast majority of their goods, and this tends to be wrapped up quite quickly. It is the more regulatory and the alignment side that tends to take a lot longer. So there's kind of two ways in this which this is likely to come about come the end of this year. One is there is an off-the-shelf solution. We've heard a lot about the Canada-style trade agreement that Boris and many of his allies want. So if you go for that kind of off-the-shelf, here's what Canada has, and you start tweaking from there, then you think that there
sure.
is
I mean,
a
we're
chance
very
that,
different economies and very different
course,
relationships in the EU.
But the other side is that there is likely to be a trade agreement light in that here's the kind of outline of where we're at. This is where we get to by the end of 2020, and now we spend the next 5 years actually refining that, and that seems to be the likely route that we're heading.
The challenge there, of course, is for Northern Ireland, where a day one is going to be the problem when it comes to new border controls and new border systems. It's not something that you can deal with in the long term.
No, and it's going to. I think that with Northern Ireland, it's going to be a case of how much can you pull the wool over the eyes in terms of saying there is no difference between the UK, the Northern Ireland, and the rest of the UK, and just hope that people don't notice the differences that actually materialise. And just keep this to certain businesses who will notice a difference in how these things are structured. And I think that, let's be honest, that's how much of these negotiations do tend to go. We do try to cover in as much detail as we can the actual the smaller details and how these things impact our everyday lives. But if it doesn't impact the vast majority of people, then it tends to be an area where you can just pull the wool over the eyes. And I think that's how this is ultimately going to go.
Finally, to mining, Anglo-American have put in a proposal for the fertiliser mine in North Yorkshire, currently owned by Sirius, which has been in problems for several years now over the issue of funding to actually keep the project going. It's a lifeline for the project, but one that comes at a big discount for investors.
Yeah, huge discount. So it's going to be around 5.5p a share. This is a stock that was at one point last year trading at 37p a share. And I think the thing that really stings here is that there are thousands of investors, I think, and a lot of them are local kind of retail investors, people who have an interest in the mine itself in terms of the local community. So they're going to feel a little hard done by in all of this. But ultimately, I think the most important thing is that this project goes ahead. No one wants to lose out on these shares that you own, especially to a massive conglomerate who looks like they're getting a bit of a discount on this. But ultimately, this is the 600 jobs that are currently at risk of being lost. But also, this has the potential to create more than 1,000 more jobs if this is made a success of. So in terms of the impact that this could have for the local community, I think the important thing is that this does move forward and that success is made of this. But as we can see from the movements in Anglo-American share price even yesterday when this deal was announced, investors aren't necessarily convinced that this is that all is good from here just because they've got a bit of a massive discount on what the share price was a year ago. It doesn't mean that this is going to be easy because it's going to take huge investment, and it seems to be quite a complex operation. So it's not going to necessarily be straightforward. But from the perspective of the northeastern, where this mine actually is, the most important thing is that this project goes ahead because of the jobs and the impact on the local community and the local economy.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, and it will be one to watch, not just because of the what's being mined itself. I mean, you could argue that it's a vote of confidence in the UK economy, but also, I suppose, how the UK might change over the next few years. But also an enormous amount of fertiliser will be coming out of the UK. The amount that's predicted will be dwarfing the rest of the market for these particular specialist chemicals. But also, just finally, on the environmental side, that to have such a large mine opening in the UK seems very much at odds with how other sort of climate change and environmental policies of the past couple of years have really seemed to be trending.
Yeah, and this has been an issue that's actually already been raised in the local area in terms of the impact, where this mine is, where the tunnelling goes, etc. The fact that it goes under the moors, I think, and that's caused a lot of controversy in the local area. And this could be another challenge that Anglo-American ultimately faces as part of this offer, is that there is enormous support in terms of the employment that this could create in the area, but there is also enormous opposition. So it is a very controversial scheme. And like you say, at a time when people are so much more environmental environmentally conscious, then that doesn't necessarily help matters. But I think we've got so far down the road now, $1 billion has already been invested. The idea that this is something that could be become a problem for Anglo American, I find that quite difficult to see at this point in time.
Sure, yeah, it's Anglo are pretty much veterans in this field and dealing with those kind of issues. So yes, one to watch. Craig Earlham there, market analyst at Oanda.
Was the Oanda podcast from the team behind Jazz FM's Business Breakfast, a daily early morning 30-minute briefing for the day ahead. On air from 6 a.m. Listen to Jazz FM on DAB, online, or just ask Alexa.